Thanks for joining us on WPR News today. Larry Mueller here, and we're talking to begin the show with Anton Troyer about his latest book. It's titled Where Wolves Don't Die. And we're also going to cover some current events going on in Indian country with Anton. He's a professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. He's authored many books, very active in Ojibwe language revitalization. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about Native Americans? How has learning about different cultures helped you understand people with different backgrounds? If you are Native American, what do you wish non-Native people would understand, maybe? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Anton Troyer, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Been a while since we last visited, and you have another book out. So let's talk about that first. It's called Where Wolves Don't Die. And it's a young reader's book. Give us an overview of the book.
Yeah, I'll be happy to do that. You know, as you mentioned, I've published many books, but this is my first work of fiction. And it's the story of Ezra Cloud. He's a 15-year-old Native kid. The journey begins in the Twin Cities, and it's both a thriller, a whodunit, and also kind of a tender coming-of-age story. Early in the book, he's embroiled in a major investigation, and his family kind of believing his innocence, but also trying to protect him from himself and being misunderstood, sends him to run a trap line with his grandfather in the Canadian wilderness. And through it all, Ezra's, you know, grappling with loss and the kind of drama unfolding in the story. And as he's kind of looking for clues to a murder, he's also finding himself. It was a lot of fun to do it.
It must have been. You sort of aimed it at younger readers. Why did you make that choice?
Well, you know, the young adult genre includes Harry Potter and things like that. I think, you know, the transition from childhood to adulthood is really an excellent entry point to look at, you know, emotional change, the arc for character development. It was just the perfect setting for thinking about what does it mean to come of age? What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be indigenous in this modern world? Also, you know, I'm at the stage now in my life, my wife and I, we have 9 children. We have 6 out the door, 3 to go. They're all in the teenager phase. And so I've been thinking a lot about, you know, parenting and about this transition. You know, it's terrifying being a parent in this world. And you got one shot at it. The number one goal is do not mess your kids up, but you don't get any do-overs. And there's so much that can trip a kid up. But there's also so much that can help them, you know, develop a beautiful life. And I think in part too, you know, I have been frustrated with Indigenous literature broadly. For starters, until the past 20 years, most of it was written by non-Native people who hadn't even talked to one of us. It would not give you authentic Native perspectives and voices and experiences. It was more like the white man's Indian, and the imaginings were usually stories of trauma and tragedy and, you know, oh, those poor people. And you read the book and you're either thinking, you know, to heck with them, shoot them all like John Wayne, or, you know, let's go hug an Indian. And, you know, for me, I always found it so ironic because I speak Ojibwe. All of my kids love to hunt, fish, gather. We do these sorts of activities. Even though we're in a modern world, we, you know, keep our culture going. And so I wanted to do something kind of different. And over the past 20 years, we've had some really great Native lit. I mean, Louise Erdrich just won a Pulitzer Prize. There's been so many great things happening. But even a lot of the indigenous authored indigenous literature are still focused on trauma and tragedy and characters who lament the culture they never had because of residential boarding schools. And I wanted to provide a window into the living, beautiful culture that is still there, to still have a character who's like navigating the things, the stories crackling with tension all the way through, and it keeps you engaged. But also, that wouldn't be an imagining of Native culture, but a window into what it actually can look like and deliver for someone.
Yeah, it's very well said. Another one of your books was selected for Minnesota's One Read program, the Young Readers Edition of your book, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. Maybe first, what's the One Read program?
You know, there have been some interesting things that were happening in Minnesota. The Shakopee Mdewakanton Sioux community had a major initiative to kind of transform the representation of Native people in education across the state. They invested about $5 million, most of which was for teacher trainings, publishing resources, things like that. But they did do a one read and book buy of Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask. So we developed teacher guides for that, educator guides. They're up for free on my website and the Understand Native Minnesota website. And they gave away 10,000 copies to schools for classroom sets. It was, you know, they were claimed in 30 minutes. It was really popular. So the Minnesota Department of Education did another 10,000 copies. And then we had actually some, a private donor to a nonprofit funded a giveaway for the Where Wolves Don't Die book, again, another 10,000 copies. And so, you know, for those in Wisconsin who are listening, you know, we have Act 31, all Wisconsin educators are supposed to learn about, you know, Native people. There's some new threads in the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction's education standards around Native stuff. And so I think they'll find it very helpful that there are free educator guides for both Where Wolves Don't Die and Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, so that people can pick it up and run with it in the classroom as well as their own reading pleasure.
Yeah. Well, Everything You Wanted to Know About Indians But Were Afraid to Ask, that is a great book, a beloved book, I think. And you and I talked about it maybe 3 years ago on the show. And it's been very positively received. Why do you think readers have responded to it so positively?
Well, you know, I think a couple of things land well with that particular book. First of all, you know, we know that the world that our children will live in, you know, is a place we can only imagine, but we have to imagine it'll be a diverse place. I think a lot of people want to get along. I think a lot of people want more than a sugar-coated version of Chris Columbus and the first Thanksgiving. And this book, you know, delivers on a wide variety of topics and provides perspective on that. But I think, you know, when we have some of the tougher topics, you know, race relations in America, politics, things like that, it gets very testy and angry. And I think the tone for the work is very positive and inviting and inclusive, even though it doesn't flinch away from or avoid, you know, tough or controversial topics. So I think it provides a way to navigate those. You know, I initially was thinking about non-Native people, but you know, I've been really heartened by its response in the Native community, too, because all of us get bombarded with the same kinds of questions. And I realized that, you know, my mother, she had a law degree and became a tribal judge. But when I finished high school, I would have been hard-pressed to explain tribal sovereignty to somebody. I got the same education everyone else in America got. And, you know, and so, like, there were some things I knew, like what it was like living in my body in a Native community, you know, but some of the other things I had to hunt for answers. In many ways, honestly, I'm still hunting. And so I'm also like not claiming, in spite of the cute title, not claiming more voice than I have. Like, there are lots of things I don't know. I shoot straight. When there are things that are a matter of perspective, I'll say, hey, natives, we don't all agree any more than white people would agree about abortion or anything else. So, you know, here are some of the issues, how they play out, some of the, you know, things that are unique to Native communities, and here's what I think. And I think that just kind of helps people identify, you know, no one's trying to sell you something. We're just trying to understand each other.
Yeah, I love that book. There were moments in it when I laughed out loud, but I remember I learned an awful lot from your book. Well, I wanted to deal with some issues that have come up, some positive things that have come up. For example, the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwa returned 12,000 acres of land. I want to get to that, but Jean in Fort Atkinson has another issue she wanted to bring up and just see if you have a comment on it. Jean, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. It's very interesting. So far, I'm definitely going to get that book and read it. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on what's going up and on it with the Bad River Tribe in northern Wisconsin.
Oh, yes.
The Land 5 issue, among other things?
Yeah, there are things that are happening in Bad River right now. So I assume you're talking about the issue with regard to the pipeline that across the reservation. Okay. Yeah, so, you know, Enbridge operates a pipeline that goes through the reservation. In recent years, there's been a bigger protest against that particular pipeline and some jurisdictional issues that have popped up. So, you know, the terms for the agreement, you know, cover certain tracts of tribal land, and the status of some pieces of land that the pipeline goes across have shifted back into tribal trust land, and the tribe is saying, we don't want this pipeline on our land, reroute it. And, you know, Enbridge has been trying to negotiate with the tribe, with probably limited effect in recent years, to get permission to keep their pipeline where it transects parcels that they did not have, that they no longer have permission to have it on. I right now, you know, it's kind of like my lawyers talk to your lawyers as far as the negotiations around it. There's a new documentary that covers this called Bad River, and it had limited theatrical release, but will be, has a streaming deal with Peacock. It should be coming out soon that discusses this. The issues are really pretty complex, but I think, you know, for a company like Enbridge, you know, back even when they were first setting up pipelines in the 40s and 50s, those guys did not do a favor to anybody working at Enbridge today. They, at that time, thought, hey, let's route this thing through the, you know, easiest route we can find politically and economically, rather than what made the most environmental sense or what respected tribal sovereignty. And today, you know, tribes are exercising their sovereignty and drawing their boundaries and standing up for their rights with much greater effect. So it's, I don't have a crystal ball that'll be able to tell you how that will be resolved. I do think that it's possible it'll be rerouted to avoid the reservation. I think it is extremely unlikely that Line 5 would be abandoned. Both because the rest of the pipeline's got its easements in place and there's so much money on the table.
Yeah. Gene, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Anton Troyer, our guest today, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University, author of many books, with him to talk about a bit about his books, but also to talk about other issues in the Native community. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. Questions for him? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Quick note, coming at noon today, we'll learn about evidence of ancient people in the Driftless area and how the archaeological sites are being preserved today. But that's at noon. Right now, taking a look at native issues. John in Madison will give you a chance. Hi, John.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I hope this isn't too far off topic, but with respect to the Bad River pipeline, or the Enbridge pipeline, you mentioned that you didn't think that it would close because there was so much money on the table. And while listening to the best of our knowledge, the indigenous folks being interviewed there were very adamant that they didn't care how much money was being offered. They wanted it gone. Can you expand on why you think that they still might reconsider that?
Oh, I don't think the tribe is likely to reconsider their position. And I don't think tribal people, you know, you might find a variety of opinions amongst tribal people, but I don't think that is going to, you know, dramatically change in the near future either. I just, you know, in my experience, when it comes to mines, pipelines, and other things, the corporations have so much money on the table, like, and so much at stake, and our political process has politicians so beholden to corporate interests that it is most likely, most of the time, that most of the mines and pipelines will get pushed through over the objections of citizens, you know, social activism, and even tribes. That doesn't happen all the time. You know, Enbridge had to abandon its proposed Sandpiper pipeline in Minnesota, in part because the delays over tribal protest and objection were so substantive and effective. So I do think there is the possibility for effect. And I do think that from what I have seen and the people I've talked to, and I mean, I am constantly in Minnesota and Wisconsin working in tribal communities. I don't think the tribe is going to change its position. And so I think Enbridge will be working on a way to reroute that pipeline around the reservation. But I don't think they would just shut off the pipeline and say, we're not going to do pipelines in Wisconsin anymore. They'll just find a different way to get it done.
Yeah.
So their position is there, you know, there are many ways to skin a cat. We'll find a different way if this one doesn't work.
John,
that's all I meant.
Yeah, John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, I mentioned Leech Lake. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe were returned 12,000 acres of land. And I think that land was originally, well, there's probably an interesting history on it. I think the Bureau of Indian Affairs seized it back in the 1940s.
Yeah, it is an interesting and complex history. So, you know, the Leech Lake Reservation, which is one of the Ojibwe reservations in northern Minnesota, and this is, by the way, where my family comes from. My relatives have been buried in the Bena Cemetery in the center of the Leech Lake Reservation longer than America's been a country. So the Leech Lake Reservation encompasses at least parts of the three of the largest lakes in Minnesota. It's, you know, kind of oddly shaped, but roughly 40 miles by 40 miles. And 85% of the Leech Lake Reservation was incorporated into an entity called the Chippewa National Forest. And it kind of was a piecemeal process, started in 1908, and then further changes made in 1928. But when that happened, it essentially took 85% of the reservation out of tribal control, especially with regard to natural resources. Sometimes it surprises people, but there's a very big difference between a national forest and a national park. So national parks are usually protected from development and clear cutting and things like that, but national forests are routinely clear cut for financial benefit, and the monies go to the U.S. federal government. And so it was always frustrating for the tribe that, you know, they have so many, they're about 10,000 tribal members, and a lot of people, you know, rely upon the woods for everything from not just recreational hunting, but subsistence hunting and fishing and things like that. And so there's been a long effort by the tribe to return the Chippewa National Forest to tribal conservatorship. Of course, by this point in time, there are lots of non-native people who also hunt in the Chippewa National Forest, and there were all kinds of concerns. This is an example of a recent push in many areas that is sometimes called land back as a restorative justice area. It's an effort to return lands to tribal control, even to have tribes steward public goods on behalf of everybody. And so a section of the Chippewa National Forest, 12,000 acre parcel, was recently, they just did the formalization very recently to the tribe. It's not the entire Chippewa National Forest, but so far it's been very positive. Some of the things that when a lot of people hear land back, they start getting scared, like, what? They want all the white people to move back to Europe? Are they going to take it all? You know, are they coming for my house? Are those natives will never pay taxes on it? You know, and those kind of things, all of which are misunderstandings. So maybe I'll briefly address them. First of all, if land is in public holding, like it's held by the federal or state government, no one has ever paid taxes on it. So it's not affecting the tax base. Second of all, you know, it's not to deny anyone else use or access, you know, necessarily. It is to switch who is the conservator for public goods. So at Leech Lake, you know, the tribe will hold the Chippewa, this section of the Chippewa National Forest, and they will actually put a moratorium on further clear cutting so that the maple groves can mature and be used for tribal harvesters, so that any remaining old growth sections can be preserved for those who use medicines. And actually, even the white guys who hunt there will have a healthier forest to hunt in, and everyone will benefit from this particular action. Each one needs to be evaluated on its own terms, and some are very big and some are very small. You know, I'm on the governing board for the Minnesota State Historical Society, and we had a couple smaller parcel repatriations to Dakota communities that were very well received by both Native and non-Native folks. So I think there are ways to do this as an effort. These are small steps in a much larger effort to rehabilitate relationships and explore what justice looks like.
Yeah, yeah. There've got to be, maybe you could comment a bit on the legal and the logistical challenges that are associated with the land bank movement.
Yes, it can be very complex. I was inside the room on all the process for what Minnesota Historical Society did. Like, there are state statutes in Minnesota that you cannot reduce the net acreage held in state conservatorship. So by repatriating a section to the tribe, they actually had to take another section in a different part of the state into state conservatorship, and had multiple agencies, the Department of Natural Resources and others, involved in this action. So it wasn't as simple as, you know, we're signing over the deed to the tribe. So it can be complex, and there are many different considerations. So environmental, legal, you know, social, and the context is different in different places. But I do think, you know, it's often misunderstood, but can be a really positive way to take some steps down the reconciliation and justice journey.
Yeah. Is it much different from, I mean, the land bank back program? Is it different from previous land reclamation efforts? Much?
I think really land back is more a broadening of previous efforts. You know, there have been a number of court cases, you know, the Indian Claims Commission and other things that we're trying to address. I think what everybody of every political persuasion would admit was just a swindling and horrible mistreatment of tribes in many different areas. But the problem is, like, our court system usually, you know, even when a tribe wins, they will say, yes, the tribe was defrauded. The government did not act in good faith. They did not do what they said they were going to do. and therefore we will write you a check. And usually there's like a monetary settlement rather than the return of land. There's really not much of a precedent for that. And then if the tribe cashes the check, they've just authorized whoever the current landholder is and denied any further possibility of them actually getting the land back. So famously, the Black Hills land case for the Lakota, it was a pretty large financial settlement, and the tribe refused to receive or spend the money. So it's still held by the U.S. government, you know, the funds, collecting interest, you know, every year, and they still won't take the money. And those are very economically disadvantaged tribal communities. But on principle, they say, we really want the land, not the money.
Oh, man. Are there other areas in Minnesota or Wisconsin where, or, you know, in the Midwest where land bank, I always want to say land bank, it's land back, has been successful or at least in the process of trying to reach agreement on some land back?
Oh, yes, many others. You know, in the American, you know, West, there have been proposals to actually have tribes steward even some national park lands. There have been numerous, much smaller repatriations. Some municipalities have authorized a voluntary land tax, where essentially there's a little, like when you do your property taxes, there's an option to click, yes, I want to pay a voluntary land tax, and then that tax goes to the tribe rather than to the municipality. But it's voluntary rather than compulsory. But there have been a number of experiments with different ways to work at restorative justice. In both the United States and Canada, there have been numerous court cases. Canada actually had a really big one. The Huron-Robinson Treaty was a $10 billion financial settlement, and the First Nations there are talking about tithing a huge portion of the money, like $250 million, for language revitalization as a restorative justice measure rather than just, you know, paying out money to tribal members. So there are lots of interesting things happening, you know, thinking about what would justice look like. And, you know, honestly, when you look big picture at these things, for any of the many injustices humans have visited upon each other throughout time, there's no way to go back in time. There's no way to, like, undo the Nazi Holocaust or, you know, things like this. You know, but there are ways to go forward. And I think some of the things that provide meaningful redress include major education and public awareness efforts, where there have been profound economic, you know, or social impacts on a population that was oppressed. I think there are public actions we can take that will, you know, provide a way to address that. So some places have, you know, put money into scholarships for people from disadvantaged groups or things like that. But I think this land back effort is one, you know, tribes are in a different position than a lot of other groups who've experienced oppression in America in that there are distinct political entities, you know, Native nations that predate the United States. So there's a different vehicle for even receiving, you know, land or something like that. So I think some of the issues, you know, are distinct with natives and native communities and tribes, but that doesn't mean anything will ever make it perfectly right. And in many ways, getting to forgiveness is not saying that something bad that happened is okay. It says this happened, we can't change it. And I choose, you know, now to accept that and go forward. And going forward can be renewing the relationship, you know, between various parties or releasing the relationship. And I think some of our big public debates about statues or art in public spaces and things like that are an effort to renegotiate what things should we put, you know, give primacy of place in our shared spaces?
Mm-hmm. You mentioned languages and language, and of course, that one of your areas of deep interest is native languages. And give us a sense of the number and complexity of native languages in the Americas.
Oh, you know, first of all, there are about 7,000 languages on planet Earth right now, of which 2,500 are spoken only by elders. So we're seeing big language loss. Like, people are aware that we're having climate change and, you know, extinction issues with different species, but this is happening with bodies of knowledge and human ways of knowing. Within the Americas, we actually have, you know, over 500 languages originally in what's now Canada and the United States. And then when you look at Mexico and South America, there are many, many more than that. Many of these languages are endangered. Like in the U.S. and Canada, we've gone from 500 languages originally spoken. Right now, depending on what study you're looking at, maybe 163 are still spoken. Of those, only about 20 are spoken by significant numbers of children. So, you know, if we're going to keep those things going, then it really depends on the depth and breadth of our interventions around them right now.
I think someone might, not me, but someone might ask, why, what's the importance of keeping those languages?
Oh, yes. It, you know, it is a common question, and it's not a mean-spirited one, but it's easy to privilege a body of knowledge or way of knowing that we're familiar with. Like, we can solve a lot of our problems with science, but we don't want to abandon all the other ways of knowing. You can also solve some really big problems with art and music. Like, it's one of the most common unifying things that all humans can agree about. But we can't solve all of our problems with art and music. You know, and embedded in each language are unique ways of looking at the world and unique ways of solving problems. You know, we've been doing colonization for a long time. Colonization is taking one language, culture, and religion and using it to supplant the others. It's about erasure and uses violence to do it. But when we solve all of our problems with violence, it makes a bunch of other problems. Now, why would we think that all of the problems created by the colonial way of solving problems can be solved by the colonial way of solving problems?
Yeah.
And they can't. They can't. And so we're going to need all of the different ideas and perspectives and ways of looking at the world. And I think, honestly, democracy in the history of humans, democracy is brand new. It's an experiment. And having democracy for a very large country is very new. You know, Plato, who wrote The Republic, which is one of the foundational texts, you know, the idea of democracy and voting and representative government, he thought it would work well if your country was comprised of 25,000 people. You know, we got 330 million people in America. And I think democracy will work if it can support diversity. And I think democracy will fail if it cannot. So imagine for our kids, you know, for most of the lives of most of the kids in America, there will not be, you know, a majority racial group. Everybody will have a minority experience. And, you know, I'm not saying it should be this way, but, like, there will also, we're on the way to, like, not even having a majority religious group in America. Every religious group will have a minority experience. And so if we exert our political efforts to privileging one religion, language, culture, or race over all the others, then everyone who's in the benefiting class will be in the victim class. Everybody will be hurt by that. And everybody's dehumanized when anyone's dehumanized. So like it or not, we're going to have to figure out how to get along, to do things together, and to support one another's different cultures, religions, races, and languages. And if we can figure out how to do that, democracy will thrive. Hmm. And if not, one's going to have an oppression experience. So there's more at stake than just another pretty bird singing in the forest. Although we love all the languages and we want all the pretty birds to be able to sing in the forest. But there's more. So, an indigenous language revitalization effort is about more than just that particular group and their right or wish to have their language. It's about how we support and respect one another.
Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. It's great to have him with us here on Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Larry Mealer. Coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk, an extension educator returns to check in on how your plants are doing midway through the growing season. And then at 12:30, Melinda Myers returns to talk about new low-maintenance flowering shrubs that have been added to the Energy Park at State Fair, and talk about the appearances. She'll be making many appearances at State Fair. Right now, speaking on Indian issues with Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University. Great to have him with us. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's take a call from Karen in Appleton. Karen, hello.
Hi there. As a young woman, I went to Bemidji when it was still a college, not a university. And I had the good opportunity to take a couple of classes by Gerald Visner, who is a Native American specialist. And I've always had an interest. We were just in Canada, and their programs for the First Nation people are so far ahead of what we're doing in the United States. And I wish that we would do more.
Karen, thanks. A comment, Anton?
Oh, I really agree with Karen. Thanks for the Bemidji State connection. Go Beavers. And yes, one of the things that our education systems can do is really pull us together and provide opportunities, not just for Native people to learn about themselves, but for everybody to learn about everybody. And, Canada had a major truth and reconciliation effort, starting really a little over a couple decades ago. There are a number of calls to action, and they've, exercised on a few of them. They still have plenty of work to do in Canada. The circumstances are kind of different, but there has been, new action at colleges and universities in Canada to build up Indigenous studies, to do more language revitalization work. I think there's been social change too. Wab Tanu was elected premier of Manitoba. So he's the top elected official in the province of Manitoba, well supported by, First Nations people, Métis communities, and white folk and everybody else. So, all of that is very positive. But there's some really distinct, issues in Canada. I've never met a First Nations person who said everything's great. I think there are still challenges with, access to economic opportunity, social and educational advancement, many different things, and sovereignty is still a major, major issue. But there's certainly, you're right, Karen, there's the mobilization of resources. It's heartening. Some of the things that are different in the United States is that, sovereignty is really configured as pre-existing the United States of America, existing in spite of all of the mistreatments of Native people throughout America's history, and it's inherent. So even with the, much more conservative Supreme Court in the United States, tribes have won their most recent major cases that have affirmed the Indian Child Welfare Act and the status of tribal lands within reservations. because of this strong legal underpinning. So that is something that has really buoyed sovereignty of tribes in America that they're still, you know, struggling to sort out in Canada. So different in both places, but I'd certainly agree with, the observation that there's a lot more happening on the education front in Canada in recent years.
Yeah. Karen, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Language, let's go back to language a bit, because I know you have worked long and hard to bring the Ojibwe language back. And maybe you could talk about your efforts.
Oh, you know, no one does work like that alone. Almost all of the major efforts, have been team things. I'll share one brief story just to give a sense for something that happened recently. So the neighboring Ojibwe reservation, Mille Lacs, in central Minnesota, gave me a call. This was maybe a year or so before the pandemic. And they said, hey, we have some monies, there are overages from grants and other things, and we would like to do something meaningful about language revitalization. I said, well, how much money are you talking about? They said, it's about $14 million. So after nearly spitting my teeth out, I started giving them a list of things. They had identified only 25 remaining fluent first speakers in all of Mille Lacs, their 6,000 tribal members. And I said, they're all elders over 70. You're not going to send them all back to college to get degrees and come teach for you for another 30 years. We have to do something else. I said, why don't we develop Rosetta Stone for Ojibwe? That's a language learning tool, kind of like Duolingo or Babbel. I said, let's develop some new books so we can work on a literacy initiative in the language. And they looked at me and they said, well, let's do all of it. And we started working. We paired up a transcriber with each of their fluent speakers. We had to teach people how to work through the pandemic. So we sent a grandkid and a computer to each elder's house. And it was amazing how productive those elders were. We published the first 5 books, had partnerships with our historical society to publish them. Rosetta Stone came out. And they have a major multi-year development. There were lots of things to think about. We worked the contract so the tribe would retain copyright of everything, could repurpose it. They made it free for tribal members and a nominal fee of $25 for everybody else. And even with that, they will recuperate their entire investment over the life of the project. And we had tragedies too, the pandemic. 6 of those 25 elders passed away. That was 20% of the fluent speakers in Mille Lacs. And when it was finally safe to come together and celebrate, Joe Naquanabe, he's one of the elders there. He's a ceremonial drum chief and was working on all these projects with us. And we asked him to speak. And, his sister had died from COVID, and his brother had COVID and had heart complications and passed away during the pandemic. And I thought he would just say, this is the toughest time. And he kind of floored me when he said, we've been through a lot. We've been through a lot the past few years, and we've been through a lot the past few hundred years. But I have to say, seeing all of these young people coming around, seeing what we've been able to build, knowing that our elders will be teaching people our language for hundreds of years to come, I have to say that this was the happiest time of my life.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
It kind of floored me, So it was a reminder that doing this kind of work, yes, it is healing for young people who want to learn our language and culture, but it is healing for our elders, too, who want to keep it going even after they're gone.
Wow. And it sounds as though there, even though it's just been a few years, there's been some really good success there.
Yeah, it's humans, right? Like we have things that are awesome. We have things that are troubling, and they're all wrapped up in the same, fry bread taco, so to speak. So, I think one of the things that has happened in America is most of us, like 87% of the educational standards that even mention Native people, it's all stuff from before 1900. It's stories of tragedy and trauma. I find, especially when I go to the American South or the East Coast, where a lot of the natives were moved off to Oklahoma and stuff like that. I've even had people say, it's a shame they killed all the Indians. And I'm telling them, hold on a minute, I'm feeling pretty good today. And then they're like, oh, yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point. Like, it's not even on the radar screen. And so, you know, I think that we've just been conditioned to think of trauma and tragedy. And really, it's one of the things I was trying to do, and I think, you know, succeeding at with regard to Where Wolves Don't Die, my new book, which is a young adult fiction work, is that, you know, we're going to hold up something that's not just trauma and tragedy. And we're going to talk about, you know, how people can deal with the things and get to a healthier, more positive place. I have a lot of hope for where we go in Indian country.
Yeah. We're starting to run out of time here, but a good email, I think, from Francis. Could you please address the type of language we white people use around Native Americans? Francis thinks we should address Native people as First Nation people instead of Indians, which has a lot of racial connotations.
Oh, yeah. So it's a great question, like what terminology should we use, Indian, American Indian, Aboriginal, Indigenous, First Nation person or what? Unfortunately, this is not a settled debate, just like the, you know, Hispanic/Latino, Latina, Latinx, Latinx community's been going round and round, and the Black African-American community has also been going round and round. We have too. I agree with her. I would love to have this be settled for everybody's benefit, you know, something without too many syllables that everybody agrees on that speaks to our sovereignty. Maybe we could use Native Nations instead of First Nations if we need to distinguish from our Canadian brothers and sisters. But, you know, it's debated internally, and there are a lot of issues. Like, if you use Indigenous, it's broad and inclusive, but that can also be, you know, an Indigenous person from New Zealand who happens to be in America. If you need to clarify the legal status of Natives, that's part of why American Indian hasn't quite died yet. So, you know, what I usually tell people to do is just have the conversation with your Native stakeholders. If it's a K-12 school, your Native parent committee, if it's college, your Indigenous advisory council, ask them what you want to do, and you can follow their advice. And then that puts you in touch with your Native stakeholders and gets you a get out of getting beat up around the ears card. And we can all use one of those.
So what are you going to be teaching this coming year at Bemidji State, Anton?
Oh, I'm really excited for this coming school year. I teach a lot of language classes, but I do a lot of other stuff in Indigenous studies. Like a lot of state universities, we had a budget crisis in the previous year. Our Native programs, you know, came through that okay. But we kind of have to make our own luck as we go forward. So I'm really looking forward to that. And, you know, there's a lot of other really exciting work happening outside of the university, you know, in language revitalization, culture stuff, of course, the new books, and so forth. So there is always a lot cooking in my universe.
I know that for sure. Anton, always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope we get to do this again soon. Thank you so much.
I look forward to that. Thank you.
Anton Troyer, professor of Ojibwe at Bemidji State University, author of many books. His latest, and I've had a chance to read part of it, it's a good book. It's titled Where Wolves Don't Die. It's a young reader's book, but I'm young at heart. And you may be too, and you may want to take a look at it too. Where Wolves Don't Die by Anton Troyer. Coming up, we're going to take a look at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. That's next. I'm Larry Mailer for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking now about the history of the Kickapoo Valley Reserve with our guest, Brad Steinmetz. He is a retired teacher, lives in Lafarge, has an active interest in local history. He's written three books, history books, a two-volume history of Lafarge, and a book on the Lafarge Dam Project. And we'll certainly get into that discussion as we move along today. Have you visited the Kickapoo Valley Reserve? Tell us what you liked about it. Questions about it? I hope you'll join in. Do you know the history of the Lafarge Dam Project? Maybe we'll get some callers from that particular area to join in. But you can join in, too. Call us at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Brad Steinmetz, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Oh, good to be here.
For those who haven't been, sort of give us, I sort of said where it was located, but give us the scale here that we're talking about.
Well, the Kickapoo Valley Reserve is actually the largest piece of public land in southern Wisconsin. It's almost 9,000 acres. It's located between Lafarge and Ontario in Vernon County, and is land that was purchased by the federal government back in the 1960s and 1970s for the proposed Lafarge Dam Project. And so some 140 people, families, were moved off their properties, and this was going to be, part of it would have been submerged in a small lake, and others would have been recreation areas around that body of water and that type of thing.
Yeah,
that project, of course, never happened, and the dam was never completed or any of that stuff was done. And eventually the federal government turned the land over to the state of Wisconsin, and the reserve was created in late 1990s. A lot of planning went into it, and the property was finally transitioned from the federal over to the state in late December of 2000. And then that's when the reserve was officially created.
And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, did it have a portion of it too, or part of that agreement?
Yes, it was interesting that when the federal government was going through the process of turning this land over to the state, one of the things they had to do was they had to offer it to any other federal agency. And they didn't get any interest, except the Bureau of Indian Affairs was interested in the land, particularly since the Ho-Chunk Nation had previously lived in this area and had many stories and parts of their oral history that were associated with the Kickapoo Valley. Hadn't had a lot of contact with the area in some time, but this lived on in their story. And so they were very much interested in it. So when that happened, the Corps invited the Corps of Engineers, who owned the land, they invited the elders of the Ho-Chunk Nation to come to the area and take a look at what they had and what was available. And the elders came down and they had these stories, but they really didn't exactly know where some of the places were. And it was interesting how they linked up with former landowners who had owned this land and started to find some of these places. And I was on one of the walking trips when one of the former landowners, James Daines, and some of the elders from the Ho-Chunk Nation, we were going to go out on the farm where James was raised and his father had owned and actually sold to the federal government. And so we were walking out to go up to a place called Black Hawk Rock, which is a promontory on the in the Kickapoo Valley in that area. And there were some significant Ho-Chunk places there that had been identified in their oral history. And as we were walking up there, James is with the elders from the Ho-Chunk Nation, Rex Wakeall and others at that time. And he said, well, what about this big mound over here? And he points off to his right, and the elders had no idea what he was talking about. And so he said, well, come on. And we walked off to the right, and about a quarter mile away, went up into this little grove of trees. And there was this rather massive mound kind of hidden by this little forest. And they really, the Ho-Chunk really were not aware that it was there. And James explained that when the first white settlers came into the area in the 1850s, they unfortunately brought with them lots of diseases that the Native Americans had no way of fighting against. And there was a massive amount of Native Americans who had died during that time. And this was where they had buried a lot of those people. And it was interesting that the white people in the area at that time would actually come up and helped creating the mound and putting the people in that burial mound. So that was really significant to me, because here was a place that was going to be very important to the Ho-Chunk Nation that they really didn't even know about. And so we, after that, then we walked up to Black Hawk Rock, and they showed us some petroglyphs in a little cave in that area. And then they started telling us about the significance of that place. They'd held sweat lodges there. It was very, very important site for them for a variety of reasons, really. And they also pointed out to us something that I was not aware of, was that there was actually a marker tree. And they would take trees, young trees, bend branches and virtually form arrows out of the branches, which would point toward these sites. And so as we started to learn about that, then we started to have some ideas where some of these other sites were at. In the end, then, the Ho-Chunk chose 1,200 acres of this 9,000. Then it was going to be held in trust for the Ho-Chunk Nation. They didn't want to change anything. They didn't want to develop anything. They wanted to put anything there. They wanted to go along with the reserve's basic premise that this land would be preserved and it would be used for recreation. People, you know, hike and that kind of thing, and education. And I can remember one of our first classes that I taught out on the reserve was actually on Ho-Chunk land. And it was a combination of, we were talking about when the Ho-Chunk were there, and we actually walked up to Black Hawk Rock to see some of that history. And then the last people, the Munson family, who had owned the farm that had been sold to the federal government, you know, for the dam project. And there were actually some of their relatives there. So we could go through that and tell about the, you know, the different times that people had lived on this land. Yeah. Very interesting.
Very, very interesting. And now, as you look at the reserve, it's the home to more than, I think it's 450 archaeological sites?
Yes, it is. It's a massive number, and part of that is because when the Corps of Engineers was developing the idea of putting this dam in north of Lafarge, one of the first things they did was they contacted the Wisconsin Historical Society. And they said, you know, if we buy all this land up and we take these people off the land that live there now, we do have to know about significant historical sites that may be out there. And so starting in the early 1960s, groups of people from the Wisconsin Historical Society and UW students, archaeology students basically, would come to Lafarge for a month, 6 weeks, and they would basically go out and they would walk this land and they were looking for these sites that potentially might be underwater or have to be moved or whatever kind of thing. And they did that. It was kind of a basic thing. They went and they talked to local people. And they said, do you know of any of these kinds of things like shelters and petroglyphs and mounds and all of that kind of thing? And of course, people who had lived in the valley all those years, generations, families going back 100 years, they knew of some of these places. One of the first that the Historical Society went to was a petroglyph called the Hansen Rock Petroglyph. And it was just north of Lafarge. It was a petroglyph that was located on a sandstone wall, basically right above the Kickapoo River. It was a very interesting petroglyph, although the people from the Historical Society didn't know what it was. And they took photos and they took chalk and they traced in the lines so it would be more visible. I'm not sure you would want to do that today. I don't think that probably carries over today. But anyway, because they had never seen anything like it. So they go back to Madison and they, you know, they get all the UW people and all of the people in the Historical Society and say, what do we have here? And nobody knew what it was. And so there was an archaeological convention coming up. So they took this to that convention. And immediately, some of the people, archaeologists, especially from the West, well, said, these are the people 5,000 years ago who were running around chasing after mastodons or whatever you had. And we didn't realize that they were east of the Mississippi. It was the first time it had ever been seen. And so you had at that point, very early on, the recognition that these people 5,000 years ago were living in the Kickapoo Valley and creating these petroglyphs. And so then that just set off a frenzy for the next decade. And what's interesting about that is that because the dam project was stopped, but then there was this long 20-year delay where nothing happened to the land, the Historical Society could continue coming out every summer and keep looking for more and more of these sites, which, you know, they found. And it was really interesting that this, you cited that number previously about how many of these are on the reserve. It's because of that intense research that was done for 20-30 year period.
Yeah,
it's most places you can't get that because, you know, people are farming it or whatever. And so it's really interesting how that all came up.
Brad Steinmetz, our guest today, author, local historian, retired teacher, lives in Lafarge. And we're talking with him about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. Questions, comments, maybe an experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And if you haven't been there, we have thousands of acres in the Kickapoo Valley set aside for you and for me to hike or canoe or fish or hunt or cross-country ski or just observe the nature of that area. It has over 450 archaeological sites. We've been talking about the reserve and zeroing in a bit on those sites with our guest, Brad Steinmetz, author and local historian. He's written a lot about Lafarge area, lives in that area, and it's great to have him with us. Join in. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. And I also did want to mention just in passing that our next book club selection, a little less than a month away, if you haven't read it yet, grab a copy. It's titled Blue Lake, and the author is Jeffrey Bolt. We'll talk with him on August 22nd, so I hope you can read along on that. In the meantime, give us a call with your questions, comments, or experiences about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Here we were talking about petroglyphs, and these are basically their images carved into the sandstone. Right, Brad? And they may be birds or other things as well.
Yes, the Hanson's Rock petroglyph that we were talking about earlier, that was it appeared to be like a mother bird with its wings spread out, and then there were two smaller, like chicks, underneath one of the wings. And the beauty of these is, it links us to that time when those people were there. The problem with like that particular petroglyph is it's out in the open and it's on a rather soft sandstone. And so it has deteriorated over the years. And I saw a photo of the petroglyph here about a year or two ago. And it was kind of startling how much it had deteriorated. But at least, we have what it did look like and that type of thing. When we have other petroglyphs that are located inside rock shelters and that type of thing, those, because they're protected from the weather, they have a much better situation of being preserved and kept more or less intact. It's kind of interesting, when all of these sites were being found in the Upper Kickapoo Valley, these historic sites, prehistoric sites, it brought in a lot of archaeologists and people of that sort to find these places. And as Kickapoojans are wont to do, someone, says, well, I got a really nice petroglyph on my place. And somebody says, oh, I got a better one over here on mine. And, well, as it turned out, there was an amazing cave, not in the Kickapoo Valley, but over on the western branch of the Kickapoo, not very far away. That had amazing petroglyphs in it. And one day I was in the Rockton Bar having lunch, and the owner of the bar, Dean Hamilton, goes, hey, he says, you're a history guy. You ought to go talk to those guys over at that table. I said, why? He said, well, they're here about the Native American petroglyphs and all that kind of stuff. So I walked over and then he went to the table and told them who I was. And so we kind of got together. And so they started describing this amazing cave with these variety of petroglyphs. And that cave is unique in that it shows different age in times when Native Americans were in that structure and making those petroglyphs. So it's just an amazing find. And eventually the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse Archaeological Center took it over, and I was actually able to go to the site and see it. It's really quite amazing. But again, that comes from all of that research that was done because of the delay in the dam project and what are we going to do with this land and all of that kind of thing, which just kept this research continuing and led to these amazing discoveries.
Yeah. What years or time periods, I guess we should say, did the all of the sites go back to? It goes back 10,000 years, doesn't it?
It does. And you know, that Hansen's Rock petroglyph placed people in the Kickapoo Valley 5,000 years ago. And then, you know, we have further evidence that there were people, you know, before that. And so you can just kind of go through every one of those ages, and you have those different groups that were in there. We know, for instance, that, you know, you're probably familiar with the Boaz mastodon, which is actually on the UW campus. And that was found in 1897 in a little town called Boaz between Richardson Center and Reachdown, just off the Kickapoo Valley a little ways. And the mastodon was found, and there was a spear point in the rib cage of that animal, which indicated that the people killed it, probably for food. And it also indicated, you know, we knew the mastodons were, we didn't know the people were there, but that was found. And the Boaz mastodon, interesting story. The owners of the land kept the mastodon and then basically rented it out to a circus, which ran around the whole state and Midwest showing this mastodon off. And then finally there was a curator at the Historical Society, which was just getting going big time. And they're going, oh my God, you can't have this out there where people, you know, you gotta, you know, save this kind of thing. So he got them to donate it to the university. And so it's been kept, it used to be in the front hall of the archaeology center there. I'm not sure. I think it's been moved since then, but that shows, you know, that finding with that Clovis point, spear point that was in its ribcage, said, hey, there were people here, you know, 10,000 years ago, which is how you come up with that information.
Well, I want to focus on, there's so many, there's several different types of sites, and we've zeroed in a lot on petroglyphs, but there are, and I think you mentioned rock shelters in passing and burial mounds. Let's focus on those rock shelters for a few minutes. What do those look like, those rock shelters?
Well, they're different, and it's interesting is that very close to the visitor center at the reserve, you can walk for 5 minutes and you can loop around a little rock cliff there, and there's a small shelter that was used, and it's interesting that when the reserve is created, they were saying, well, they used to, you know, actually live in this shelter. And so there were two young men who decided they would go deer hunting, and they were going to live in that shelter to see if they could stay overnight and in the winter of Wisconsin and go deer hunting and all that kind of, and they did. And it was really an interesting concept. But then you have other rock shelters that are as large as a 2 or 3 room apartment where, you know, dozens of people could stay. And there's one in particular on the reserve that is very, very difficult to get to. It has a marker tree that shows you how to get there, but it's quite a little trek to get down to it. And it's really very much hidden, which is good because you don't want everybody going into it. And so when you get to that, you can understand, well, yes, the people could winter over in this climate with that kind of a shelter. And there was, and you can actually see one of the rooms, all of the sandstone walls are black because they had the fire in that room and the smoke and that kind of thing. And they'd actually kind of poked a hole up through once at the top so the smoke could get out. But still, you know, that was the room where the fire was always held and that kind of thing. So they are really kind of amazing to show that those people, you know, from the Ho-Chunk, the last group that was there, to others before them, could stay in the climate during those times.
Would those rock shelters tell us about the early people's diets?
I imagine they would. You know, another thing is that the people who lived here in the Kickapoo Valley, they used the plants that were in the Kickapoo Valley. They hunted the animals that were in the Kickapoo Valley. They fished for the fish that were in the Kickapoo Valley. And that, you know, that was their diet. And an interesting story that I have from my family history was my grandmother, who was a young girl in the 1890s, and she lived up on a farm on a ridge between Lafarge and Viroqua. And at that time, what were known as the Winnebago then, but who are the Ho-Chunk, were living out in Iowa. But they wanted to come back to the Kickapoo Valley in the summertime, mainly to harvest plants, which they used for medicines and their diets. And so they would walk and have wagons travel back from Iowa to the Kickapoo Valley. And my great-grandmother was a really good baker. And she made great bread and rolls and pies and all that kind of thing. And the Native Americans would always stop at the farm to see what she was baking. And then they would trade her maple syrup and maple sugar candy, which they had done during the maple syrup season, which had been a little earlier. And of course the kids were always, and the family were always, yes, yes, they're here with the candy, you know, type of thing, which my grandmother could remember. And they would make that trade. And then those people would come down into the Kickapoo Valley. They would camp in the valley at different spots, and very traditional spots where they had camped before. And then they would go out and they would harvest these plants, mainly medicinal plants. They made poultices out of them and all kinds of things. And then at the end of the summer, in a place called Kickapoo Center, which is between Viola and Reedstown in the Kickapoo Valley, they would have a rally, and they would invite everybody in, and they would the Ho-Chunk would get the drums out, and they would do the dancing, and they would sell their products, and the people would come and really enjoy it. And then they'd pack everything up, and they would head back to Iowa for the winter, because they couldn't stay in the valley without permanent structures, which they couldn't build. And they had to go back to Iowa because the federal government had a yearly stipend or money they gave them, and they had to be back there to get that. But it's really interesting. There was in my study of Lafarge history that I've done, there was a doctor who lived in very early Lafarge, even before it was incorporated. And he used a lot of these traditional remedies of the Native Americans. And they would always stop at his office there at a place called Seeleyburg, which is the original Lafarge. And then at the end of the summer, then he would buy these items from the Native Americans for his own practice. And then they would head back to Iowa. So it's really interesting how that tradition of those remedies and medicines and things that the Ho-Chunk had moved over into the settlers' community and were used and very, very well accepted.
Kind of reminds me back to my earlier guest, Anton Troyer, and talking about how the different cultures as we were talking about languages, and he was saying we need to preserve languages in part because of the information that would be lost without having that culture represented in its language. And I think here's an example right there of one sort of culture passing on to another some really important information.
Yes, that is truly important. And as he was relating that, I was thinking about one time I was teaching a class in the reserve in the summertime. It was high school students, and the Ho-Chunk on one of their parcels of their trust land had a summer immersion camp for their high school age kids. And they would bring them down from Black River Fall, Toma, different areas, and they would camp out on this in this area, and they would have the elders there using the language and teaching the students the language. They would have the students make a chikotapoy, which is like a wigwam that the Ho-Chunk made. They would actually have them, the students, create this big wigwam area where they would stay, and it was really, really interesting. And one year when I had the class, we went out there for a day, while we were there, it was so interesting because my students from my class, they wanted to know these words that the Ho-Chunk students were using, and so they would give them a word, and then the Ho-Chunk would say the word back to them in their language. And it was really an interesting process. And then they got into talking about, well, how do you make this thing, and how do you get the branches to bend so it's round, you know, all that kind of thing. It was very, very interesting process. And I really, really hated it when the Ho-Chunk quit their immersion class, because that was a very, very interesting time to visit with them.
Brad Steinmetz, our guest today. Brad Steinmetz, an author, local historian, retired teacher, lives in Lafarge. It's great to have him with us to talk today about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve and its history. Questions, comments, experience, I hope you'll join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today as we talk with Brad Steinmetz, author, local historian, retired teacher. It's great to have him with us to talk about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And again, you can join in with your own questions or comments or maybe an experience to share at 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And a quick reminder, tomorrow on Garden Talk, we've got an extension educator checking in on how your plants are doing. And we are looking forward to that as well on tomorrow's program. But right now, we're on to the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. I wanted to go back to the mounds. We mentioned the burial mounds a time or two. I think there were three types. There was a conical type, there was an oval type, and there was a linear type. We at all three, I think, are present at some point. You could see them in the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. Was there a reason, or do we know, have any idea as to why we had these different forms or shapes for the burial mounds?
It probably indicates different peoples. And, you know, you have a particular time when the mounds were used for specific identification of the people that were living there. And interestingly enough, the mounds, the greatest amount of mounds that were in the Kickapoo Valley were in the southern part of the village of Viola at a place called Mound Park. And this was a area that had the most mounds of any place in the Kickapoo Valley. And it included the dome mounds, and it included the linear mounds. And it had actually an effigy mound there as well of a, I think it was an animal. And unfortunately, they were all plowed up, farming residences were built over them, all of that type of thing. And they were pretty much lost. But that particular site indicated generations of, or really ages of people, you know, from the different ages that, that you had in the Kickapoo Valley, of people living there and the types of mounds that they use. Now, another thing that when the Historical Society archaeologists were out and they were looking at mounds, one of the things they found was that they had mounds that would have to be moved because there was going to be new roads built and all of this type of thing. And then so they took a look at the mounds. Do they have artifacts in them? Do they have human remains in them? That type of thing. And I believe there were three actually north of Lafarge that were excavated, and the remains were shipped down to Madison. They're kept at the Historical Society. But that indicates, you know, that some were burial mounds, and it just shows the vast time differences of the people who lived in the valley and what they used the mounds for.
Absolutely amazing. We've talked a bit about the Lafarge Dam project, but you've written a history of that, and actually I can almost think I experienced a whole lot of that as part of my job here. I talked about the Lafarge Dam project on the air back a long time back, but how did this all begin? The purpose had to do in part with flooding issues.
Yes. Yeah, it was, and it's immense history, but it actually started in 1935. There was a massive Kickapoo River flood, and the flood, and there was a railroad that actually ran from Waseca down on the, you know, by the Wisconsin River all the way up to Lafarge. And the flood damaged that railroad really bad, and it was a mainstay for the village of Lafarge. The mail came in on that railroad, the products came in, the products were shipped out, all that kind of thing. So they really needed that railroad protected. So the leaders of Lafarge went to Washington, D.C. and said, can you help us with this flooding problem that we have? Now, the reason that Washington, D.C. knew about it was that there was a reporter that came out from Milwaukee, and he hired a guy who had an airplane over in Hillsboro, not too far from Lafarge, and they went up and they took pictures of the floods as it hit the villages in the Kickapoo Valley, and they were very, very dramatic. The one that showed Lafarge, which was like two-thirds underwater, ended up on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal. And then the wire services picked it up and it went national, basically. And so by the time that those Lafarge leaders got to Washington, D.C., this was New Deal time, you know, for FDR. So we want to get these programs out to the people. And they said, yeah, we'll come and look at it. So the Department of the Interior and the Corps of Engineers, which is part of the Army at that time, they came out and they started looking at it. And so that's how the idea of the dam project came along. It took them a long time to finally get there, which happened in 1962 when the very first bill was passed authorizing a dam project at Lafarge. And so, you know, when that started, then this whole process went along, and they were going to offer flood protection with that dam, and then they were also going to build dikes around the villages of Soldiers Grove and Gage Mills on the southern end of the valley to protect those areas. And eventually the project was stopped, and I don't, you know, economic and...
Well, they bought out, they bought the farms. A lot of people didn't want to sell.
Yeah, right. They were building the dam, and they were buying out the farms at the same time as it looked like they might be stopping the project. So, you know, people were going, well, we don't want to sell our farm because it's never going to happen, the type of thing. But you don't have much, you don't have any way to fight that. The federal government has an authorized project, and they can do that using power of public domain to take the land away. They pay for it, but it was very hard. And you know, there was like about 18 of the owners took it to court and said, no, we're not going to sell. And it goes to the circuit court in Madison, and Judge Doyle, the father of the Governor Doyle, he says, no, it's a federal project. They're authorized to do it, and everybody lost. And so, you know, you get your check in the mail or whatever. But it was, it was a very tumultuous time. And then, of course, when they stopped the project, those former landowners wanted their land back. Well, they couldn't get it back, and they sued to get it back, and that didn't work either. And so it was just one thing after another. And then the land sat out here for 20-some years. Corps had it, but nothing was happening. And then, of course, everybody in the area just basically used the land for whatever they wanted. And it was not such good things. Marijuana fields cropped up everywhere. mud bogging with trucks and all of that kind of thing. And so it was just a kind of a circus. And then finally, in the early 1990s, Governor Tommy Thompson and then State Senator Brian Rood put this idea together to what can we do with this land? And they came up with the idea of, well, they didn't come up with it, but they formed a committee and they came up with the idea of creating this reserve, preserving the land, and everybody could enjoy it, type of thing.
Yeah, amazing. It took a long, long time. Oh, you know, there's still got to be some resentment.
Yeah, there is. And you know, in teaching students at Lafarge, I virtually couldn't teach about the controversy because the board was all pro dam. And if I, you know, said, well, who are, you know, what are the sides of the anti-dam? And I mean, I was virtually forced to stop teaching it, or I would lose my job. And so it was funny, years later, you know, 25 years later, I'm teaching a course for adults out at the reserve. And one of my former students is in the class, and she said, well, you wouldn't teach us when we were in high school. So I have now I find out what this history of the reserve and the project, you know. So yeah, it was just a time of protest and you know, pro dam versus anti dam, and all of this kind of thing was going on. So it's very tumultuous.
Matthew in Mazamani has a question for you or a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. I just wanted to address the Kickapoo term. And as I understand it, this is an Algonquin-based word, like most Wisconsin native place names. And I know that the tribe that eventually became the Kickapoo tribe started maybe down in Ohio and would have wandered up under various pressures and ended up in the Kickapoo River area at some point, and then now we're down maybe towards Oklahoma. But I wondered... is this similar to, say, the Sioux Indian tribe, where other tribes name them, but it's not what they call themselves? Did they get the name from the river, which had already been previously named for its meandering character? To what extent, you know, does this tribe start with a name or have it applied because either they wander around or because they end up by the Kickapoo, which has already been named?
Well, it is interesting in that those people were in that valley, in the Kickapoo Valley at that time, when the French first came and were trading for furs and that kind of thing, and created this kind of a trading relationship with the people of Western Wisconsin. And that adaptation of the French name for the people became Kickapoo. And that's really how the name Kickapoo is formed. Actually, you know, as many of those nations' names were changed, most of them were picked up, like the whole chunk became the Winnebago, through English type of transitions, whereas with this one, it's actually the French pronunciation of that group of people. And it does have to do with their wandering. It does have to do with it. And the meandering nature of the river and all of that, I'm sure it's part of it, but it's an interesting idea. And it's very interesting that you mentioned the Kickapoo, because when the reserve was started, the Ho-Chunk Nation reached out to that group of people down in Oklahoma and some are down in Texas, and said, now we don't want to do anything to, you know, leave you out of this. So are you interested in, you know, what we're doing here? And they sent representatives up to the area, the Kickapoo did, and those people did, and were very, very interested in preserving the land and that type of thing. So they did become involved in that respect. They backed the Ho-Chunk and what they were doing.
Matthew, thanks again. Appreciate it. Are scientists, archaeologists, are they still working over there or studying in the reserve at all, from what you know?
I would say yes. I think it's a place that is so unique, and it is loaded with places that's still going on. It's kind of interesting. There's a big tree planting project that's going on in the reserve right now on one of the areas that has just been kind of opened up, and they're replanting rather mature oaks back into an area that would have had them before farming came along. And as they're going up through there, then they have to bring archaeologists in to see if there's anything there before they plant the trees. And wouldn't you know it, they found something. And so that tree planting has been put on hold a little bit while they make sure that they're not, you know, messing something else up from an age before, you know, type of thing. So yeah, it goes on.
Will you be teaching any more classes at the reserve?
I generally talk to adult groups now. I used to hike with the kids all the time, but I did have one group of children, school children, this spring that I talked to. But when the adult groups come along, I generally do talk to them. And I've had a couple of those that have stopped in, I've talked to in the last month or so.
Okay, but you don't have a schedule of...
No, I don't. We don't have a scheduled class anymore like we used to. But that was fun.
Well, it's been, speaking of fun, it's been fun talking with you, Brad. This has been really enjoyable. I appreciate it very much. I hope we get a chance to talk again. Thank you so much.
That'd be great. Thank you, Larry.
Brad Steinmetz, author, local historian. Excuse me. It was really fun talking with him about the Kickapoo Valley Reserve. And thank you so much for listening. It's always a lot of fun. And as always, our shows are a team effort. We've got our producers, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our technical directors, our Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. We have a lot of fun putting this show on. We enjoy it a lot, and I hope you enjoy it too. We'll be back tomorrow for Garden Talk. Stay with us, though, for WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.